Chapter 14. Abu Ghraib's Abuses and Tortures. Understanding and Personalizing Its Horrors. Naked men were stacked high in a pyramid, and American soldiers stood grinning over their prisoner pile. A female soldier was leading a naked prisoner around by a dog leash tied around his neck. Other prisoners looked horrified, as they seemed on the verge of being attacked by vicious-looking German Shepherd dogs. On and on they went, like a pornographic slideshow. Naked prisoners were made to masturbate in front of a cigarette-smoking female soldier who stood giving a high-five approval salute. Prisoners were made to simulate fellatio. It seemed inconceivable that American soldiers were tormenting, humiliating, and torturing their captives by forcing homoerotic poses upon them. Yet here they were. Still other unbelievable images buzzed by. Prisoners standing or bent over in stress positions with green hoods or women's pink panties covering their heads. Were these the fine young men and women sent overseas by the Pentagon on the glorious mission of bringing democracy and freedom to an Iraq recently liberated from the tyrant torturer Saddam Hussein? It was amazing to see that in many of the images in this horror show, the perpetrators themselves appeared along with their victims. It is one thing to do evil deeds, quite another to document one's culpability in graphic, enduring photos. What had they been thinking as they made their trophy photos? Finally, the soon-to-be iconic image of a psychological torture appeared. A hooded prisoner was precariously perched on a cardboard box, with his arms outstretched and electric wires attached to his fingers. He'd been led to believe, by Sergeant Davis, that if his legs gave way and he fell off the perch, he would be electrocuted. His hood was lifted briefly to see the wires leading from the wall to his body. They were false electrodes that aimed at inducing anxiety, not physical pain. How long he shuddered in absolute fear for his life, we don't know. But we can readily imagine the trauma of his experience and empathize with this hooded man. At least a dozen images swept across the screen. I wanted to turn off the TV but could not look away because I was captured by the vivid power of the pictures and their violation of expectation. Before even beginning to entertain hypotheses about what could possibly have induced such behavior in these soldiers, I was assured, along with the rest of the nation, that the torture was the work of only a few bad apples. General Richard B. Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in a television interview, declared his surprise at these allegations and astonishment at the images of criminal abuse. However, he said, he was certain that there was no evidence that the abuses were systemic. To the contrary, he asserted that they were the isolated work of a handful of rogue soldiers. According to this authoritative military spokesperson, fully 99.9% of American soldiers were performing in exemplary fashion overseas, meaning that there was no need to be alarmed at the less than 1% of them who were defective soldiers carrying out these abominable abuses. "Frankly, I think all of us are disappointed by the actions of the few," said Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, interviewed on the 60 Minutes 2 show. "Every day we love our soldiers, but frankly, some days we're not always proud of our soldiers." It was comforting to know that only a few rotten soldiers serving as prison guards in America's many military prisons were engaged in such unthinkable acts of wanton torture. Wait a minute. How could General Myers know that this was an isolated incident before having conducted a thorough investigation of his system of military prisons in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Cuba? The exposé had just been revealed. There had not been sufficient time for anyone to have done a thorough investigation in order to make such an assertion. There was something troubling about the authoritative declaration to absolve the system and blame the few at the bottom of the barrel. His claim was reminiscent of what police chiefs tell the media whenever police abuse of criminal suspects is revealed. Blame the few rotten apple bad cops, to deflect the focus away from the norms and usual practices in the back rooms of police stations or the police department itself. This rush to attribute a bad boy dispositional judgment to the few offenders is all too common among the guardians of the system. In the same way, school principals and teachers use that device to blame particularly disruptive students instead of taking the time to evaluate the alienating effects of boring curricula or poor classroom practices of specific teachers that might provoke such disruptions. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld denounced the acts as terrible and inconsistent with the values of our nation. The photographic depictions of U.S. military personnel that the public has seen have unquestionably offended and outraged everyone in the Department of Defense, he said. Any wrongdoers need to be punished, procedures evaluated, and problems corrected. Then he added a statement that obliquely took the heat off the military for their lack of appropriate training and preparation of Army Reserve military police for such a difficult mission. If someone doesn't know that doing what is shown in those photos is wrong, cruel, brutal, indecent, and against American values, I am at a loss as to what kind of training could be provided to teach them. However, Rumsfeld was also quick to redefine the nature of these acts as abuse and not torture. He said, "What has been charged so far as abuse, which I believe technically is different from torture, I'm not going to address the torture word." Time out for another pause in this narrative. To what technicality is Rumsfeld referring? As media carried these images worldwide on primetime TV, on the front pages of newspapers, in magazines, and on websites for days on end, President Bush launched an immediate and unprecedented damage control program to protect the reputation of his military and his administration, especially his Secretary of Defense. He dutifully declared that he would form independent investigations that would get to the bottom of this. I wondered if the president would also order investigations that might get to the top of this scandal so that we could see the full picture and not just its frame. It would seem so, given that his deputy director for coalition operations in Iraq, Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, publicly declared, "I'd like to sit here and say that these were the only prisoner abuse cases that we're aware of, but we know that there have been some other ones since we've been here in Iraq." Doesn't this contradict General Myers's assertion that it was an isolated incident and not systemic? In fact, there have been so many cases of abuse, torture, and homicide uncovered since the Abu Ghraib scandal blew the lid off that by April 2006, more than 400 separate military investigations had been launched into such allegations, according to Lieutenant Colonel John Skinner, U.S. Department of Defense. Two other public reactions to the abuse photos are worthy of our notice, one by a famous media personality, another expressing the outrage of a United States congressman. To the arch-conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh, the photos, such as the one of a pyramid of naked prisoners, seemed little more than a college prank. "This is no different than what happens at the Skull and Bones, a Yale University secret society. Initiation. And we're going to ruin people's lives over it, and we're going to hamper our military effort, and then we are going to really hammer them, the accused soldiers, because they had a good time. You know these people are being fired at every day. I'm talking about people having a good time, these people. You ever heard of emotional release? You heard of need to blow some steam off? Torture as emotional release? Catharsis for the stressed soldiers? Having a good time by just blowing off a little steam?" Those were the justifications by this influential celebrity for terrible acts of torture. One slight difference between the fraternity Hell Night scene and the Abu Ghraib torture scene is, of course, that fraternity pledges have the choice of whether to endure hazing as a testament of their commitment to joining a college society. They are not forcibly subjected without their prior consent to such humiliation and torment by a hostile enemy occupation force. Senator James Inhofe, Republican, Oklahoma, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, before which Secretary Rumsfeld had testified, was outraged. However, he avowed that he was more outraged by the outrage caused by the photographs than by what they depicted. He blamed the victims for deserving their abuse and the media for publicizing the images. "These prisoners, you know, they're not there for traffic violations. If they're in cell block 1A or 1B, These prisoners, they're murderers, they're terrorists, they're insurgents. Many of them probably have American blood on their hands, and here we're so concerned about the treatment of those individuals. He continued his attack by arguing that the media were provoking further violence against Americans around the world by publicizing the outrage caused by showing the photos. The Pentagon used similar reasoning in its effort to block the release of these images. However, Major General Donald Ryder's internal army report challenged the view that these prisoners were violent, noting that some Iraqis were held for long periods simply because they had expressed displeasure or ill will toward U.S. forces. Other accounts make it evident that many of the inmates were innocent civilians, according to the prison superintendent, Brigadier General Janice Karpinski. They had been picked up in military sweeps of towns where insurgent activity had occurred. In these sweeps, all the male family members, including young boys, were incarcerated in the nearest military prison and then often taken to Abu Ghraib for questioning. Although I have seen many horrifying images of extreme abuse in conducting research on torture in Brazil and in preparing lectures on torture, something at once struck me as being different and yet familiar about the images that were emerging from the exotically named Abu Ghraib prison. The difference had to do with the playfulness and shamelessness displayed by the perpetrators. It was just fun and games, according to the seemingly shameless Private Lindy England, whose smiling face belied the chaos going on around her. Nevertheless, a sense of the familiar was haunting me. With a shock of recognition, I realized that watching some of these images made me relive the worst scenes from the Stanford prison experiment. There were the bags over prisoners' heads, the nakedness, the sexually humiliating games that entailed camels humping or men leapfrogging over each other with their genitals exposed. These comparable abuses had been imposed by college student guards on their college student prisoners. In addition, just as in our study, the worst abuses had occurred during the night shift. Moreover, in both cases, the prisoners were being held in pre-trial detention. It was as though the worst-case scenario of our prison experiment had been carried out over months under horrendous conditions, instead of in our brief, relatively benign, simulated prison. I had seen what could happen to good boys when they were immersed in a situation that granted them virtually absolute power in dealing with their charges. In our study, the guards had had no prior training for their roles and been given only minimal staff supervision to curtail their psychological abuse of prisoners. Imagining what could happen when all the constraints that operated in our experimental setting were removed, I knew that in the Abu Ghraib prison, powerful situational forces must have been in play, and even more dominating systemic forces had to have been at work. How could I ever know the truth about the behavioral context in that far-off situation, or uncover any truth about the system that had created and maintained it? It was apparent to me that the system was now struggling mightily to conceal its own complicity in torture. Making sense of senseless abuses. The design of the Stanford prison experiment made it evident that initially our guards were good apples, some of whom became soured over time by powerful situational forces. In addition, I later realized that it was I, along with my research team, who was responsible for the system that made that situation work so effectively and so destructively. We failed to provide adequate top-down constraints to prevent prisoner abuse, and we set an agenda and procedures that encouraged a process of dehumanization and de-individuation that stimulated guards to act in creatively evil ways. Further, we could harness the system's power to terminate the experiment when it began to spin out of control, and when a whistleblower forced recognition of my personal responsibility for the abuses. In contrast, in trying to understand the abuses that took place at Abu Ghraib, we are starting at the end of the process, with documented evil deeds. Therefore, we have to do a reverse analysis. we have to determine what these guards might have been like as people before they were assigned to guard the prisoners on those tiers of that Iraqi prison. Can we establish what pathologies, if any, the guards might have brought into the prison in order to separate their dispositional tendencies from what that particular situation might have brought out in them? Next, can we uncover what the behavioral context into which they were thrust was like? What was the social reality for the guards in that particular setting at that particular time? Finally, we must discover something about the power structure that is responsible for creating and sustaining the working and living conditions of all the inhabitants of that dungeon, Iraqi prisoners and American guards alike. What justification can the system provide for using this particular prison to house detainees indefinitely without legal recourse and to interrogate them using coercive tactics? At what levels was the decision made to suspend the safeguards of the Geneva Conventions and the military's own rules of conduct regarding prisoners, namely, banning any actions that are cruel, inhuman, and degrading in the treatment of them? Those regulations provide the most basic standards of conduct in the treatment of prisoners in any democracy, whether in times of war or peace. Nations put them into practice, not so much out of charitable goodwill, but to ensure the decent treatment of their own soldiers, should they be captured as prisoners of war. Not trained as an investigative reporter, and not having the means to travel to Abu Ghraib or to interview the key participants in these abuses, I had little reason to expect that I would be able to get to the top or to the bottom of this intriguing psychological phenomenon. It would be a shame not to be able to bring to bear an understanding of this seemingly senseless violence based on my unique insider knowledge from having been the superintendent of the Stanford prison. What I learned from the SPE paradigm about investigating institutional abuses is the need to evaluate various factors, dispositional, situational, and systemic, that lead to the behavioral outcome we want to understand. I was also curious as to who it was who had shined the spotlight on the abuses going on in that prison dungeon. Joe Darby, heroic whistleblower, ordinary guy. The young soldier who blew the whistle on that little shop of horrors and exposed its dark deeds to public scrutiny was a 24-year-old Army reservist, Joe Darby. That young man is a hero because he forced the military officials to acknowledge the existence of such abusive practices and act to rein them in all their prisons. Darby was in the same 372nd Military Police Company as the military police on night shift duty in the prison. But he was not working on that assignment. One day, his buddy, Corporal Charles Grainer, gave Darby a CD filled with hundreds of digital images and video clips that he and the other guards had taken. A few of the images had already made the rounds in their unit. Some were even displayed on computer screensavers. Darby was at first amused looking at the pictures, thinking it was pretty funny to see a pile of naked Iraqis in a pyramid showing their asses. But the more he looked, the more distressed he felt at what he saw. "It didn't sit right with me," he said. He felt it was wrong for Americans to be doing such terrible things to other people, even if they were foreigners imprisoned in a war zone. "I couldn't stop thinking about it. After about 3 days, I made a decision to turn the pictures in," Darby reported. He agonized over that decision, torn between loyalty to his friends and the urging of his moral conscience. Darby had known Lindy England since basic training. "Nevertheless," he said, "what he saw violated everything I personally believed and all I'd been taught about the rules of law." So on that day in January 2004, Joe Darby made a giant leap for moral mankind by first handing over a copy of the CD with an anonymous note in a manila envelope to an agent at the Criminal Investigation Division, CID. He later confided to Special Agent Tyler Perron, U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command at Abu Ghraib Prison, that he was the one who put the CD in the envelope and was willing to talk to CID more fully. Darby wanted to remain anonymous as long as he continued working at Abu Ghraib, for fear of retaliation for having ratted on his buddies in this way. It took enormous personal courage for Darby to blow the whistle so loudly, knowing that it would surely make trouble for his buddies in the 372nd who appeared on the CD. Nevertheless, when others were doing the wrong thing, Darby did the right thing. We must also take into account that his military status was at the bottom rung, a specialist in the Army Reserve. He was openly challenging what was going on in a military-run prison. A prison, as I later discovered, a section of which was a special interrogation center created by the Secretary of Defense himself to elicit actionable intelligence from terrorists and insurgents. It took fortitude for Darby to challenge the system. Apple Blossom Time in the Nation's Capital. Chance suddenly sent good fortune my way. A former Stanford student, working at National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., recognized the parallels between the photos of Abu Ghraib and those I had shown in my course lectures about the Stanford prison experiment. He tracked me down in my D.C. hotel to do an NPR interview shortly after the story surfaced. The main point of my interview was to challenge the administration's bad apple excuse with an alternative bad barrel metaphor that I derived from the similarity between the Abu Ghraib situation and the Stanford prison experiment. Many other TV, radio, and newspaper interviews soon fed off his first NPR interview to provide neat sound bites about assorted apples and sordid barrels. My commentary was sought by the media because it could be dramatized by vivid video and still footage from our experimental prison. This national publicity, in turn, reminded Gary Myers, counsel for one of the MP guards, that my research was relevant in highlighting the external determinants of his client's alleged abusive behavior. Myers invited me to be an expert witness for Staff Sergeant Ivan Chip Frederick II, the military policeman who was in charge of the night shift on Tiers 1A and 1B. I agreed, in part so that I could have access to all the information I needed to fully understand the role of the triadic elements in the attributional analysis of this alien behavior. The person, the situation, and the system that had put this person in that place to commit such crimes. With that background information, I hoped to more fully appreciate the dynamic transactions that had fueled these aberrations. In the process, I agreed to offer appropriate assistance to Myers' client. However, I made it clear that my sympathies were more with Joe Darby, who had been brave enough to expose the abuses, than with anyone involved in perpetrating them. Under these conditions, I then joined Staff Sergeant Frederick's defense team and embarked on a journey into this new heart of darkness. Let's begin our analysis by getting a better sense of what that place was like, that Abu Ghraib prison, geographically, historically, politically, and in its recent operational structure and function. Then we can move on to examine the soldiers and prisoners in their behavioral context. The place, the Abu Ghraib prison. 20 miles, 32 kilometers west of Iraq's capital city, Baghdad, and a few miles from Fallujah, lies the Iraqi city of Abu Ghraib, where the prison is located. It lies within the Sunni Triangle, the center of violent insurgency against the American occupation. In the past, the prison was designated by the Western media Saddam's Torture Central because it was the place where, during the reign of the Ba'athist government, Saddam Hussein arranged for the torture and murder of dissidents in twice-weekly public executions. There are allegations that some of these political and criminal prisoners were used in Nazi-like experiments as part of Iraq's chemical and biological weapons program. At any one time, as many as 50,000 people were held in the sprawling prison complex, whose name could translate into House of Strange Fathers or Father of the Strange. It had always had an unsavory reputation because it had served as an insane asylum for severely disturbed inmates in the pre-Thorazine era. Built by British contractors in 1960, it covered 280 acres, 1.15 square kilometers, and had a total of 24 guard towers encircling its perimeter. It was a sprawling small city, partitioned into 5 walled compounds, each meant to hold particular kinds of prisoners. In the center of its open yard stood a huge 400-foot tower. Unlike most American prisons, which are built in remote rural areas, Abu Ghraib is located within sight of large apartment houses and offices, perhaps built after 1960. Inside, its cells were jammed with as many as 40 people confined in a 12-foot square, 4-meter square, space, and living under vile conditions. Colonel Bernard Flynn, commander, Abu Ghraib Prison, described just how close the prison was to those attacking it. "It's a high-visibility target because we're in a bad neighborhood. All of Iraq is a bad neighborhood. There's one tower where it's built so close to the neighborhood that we can look into the bedrooms, you know, right there on the porches. There were snipers on those roofs and on those porches firing at the soldiers who were up there on the towers. So we're constantly on guard and trying to defend this and trying to keep the insurgents away from coming inside." After the U.S. forces overthrew Saddam's government in March 2003, the name of the prison was changed from Abu Ghraib to dissociate it from its unsavory past to the Baghdad Central Confinement Facility, BCCF, initials seen in many of the investigative reports. When Saddam's regime collapsed, all prisoners, including many criminals, were released, and the prison was looted. Whatever could be removed was stolen. Doors, windows, bricks, you name it, and someone stole it. Incidentally, and not reported in the media, the Abu Ghraib City Zoo was also opened and all the wild animals released. For a time, lions and tigers roamed the streets until they were captured or killed. A former CIA bureau chief, Bob Baer, described the scene he witnessed at this notorious prison. "I visited Abu Ghraib a couple of days after it was liberated. It was the most awful sight I've ever seen. I said, if there's ever a reason to get rid of Saddam Hussein, it's because of Abu Ghraib." His grim account adds, "There were bodies that were eaten by dogs. Torture. You know, electrodes coming out of the walls. It was an awful place." Although senior UK officials recommended that the prison be demolished, US authorities decided to rebuild the prison as quickly as possible so that it could be used to detain all those who were suspected of vaguely defined crimes against the coalition, suspected insurgency leaders, and assorted criminals. In charge of this motley group of detainees were Iraqi guards of dubious character. Many of those held in security were blameless, assorted Iraqi civilians who had been picked up in random military sweeps or at highway checkpoints for suspicious activity. They included whole families, men, women, and adolescents, to be interrogated for information they might have about the unanticipated growing insurgency against the coalition. Once arrested and found innocent after interrogation, they were not released, because the military feared that they would then join the insurgency, or because nobody wanted to take the responsibility for making such decisions. The towering target of mortar attacks. The imposing 400-foot tower in the center of the prison soon became the sighting focus of almost nightly mortar attacks that were launched from the tops of nearby buildings. In August 2003, a mortar attack killed 11 soldiers who were sleeping in tents outside in the yard on the soft site. In another attack, an explosive ripped through a tent filled with soldiers, among them Colonel Thomas Pappas, the head of one of the military intelligence brigades stationed at the prison. Although Pappas was unharmed, the young soldier who was his driver was shredded and died, along with other soldiers. Pappas was so affected by this sudden horror that he never again took off his flak jacket. It was reported to me that he always wore his jacket and hard helmet even while showering. He was later declared not combat fit and relieved of his duties. His deteriorating mental condition did not permit him to provide the vitally necessary supervision of his soldiers working in the prison. After the terrifying mortar attack, Pappas housed most of his soldiers inside the prison walls on the hard site, which meant that they were usually sleeping in small prison cells, just like those of the prisoners. Stories of their comrades' deaths and the constant, continuing sniper, grenade, and mortar attacks created an ambient sense of fear among everyone assigned to the prison, which came under hostile attack as many as 20 times a week. Both American soldiers and Iraqi prisoners and detainees were killed by this hostile fire. Over time, the attacks destroyed some of the prison complex and left buildings burned out and debris everywhere in sight. The mortar shelling was so frequent that it became part of the surreal surrounding of the Abu Ghraib madness. Joe Darby recalls discussions with buddies as they tried to figure out the size and location of the mortar after hearing the boom of its launch, whether it was 60 or 80 millimeter, or even big enough to be a 120 millimeter explosion. However, that psychic numbness in the face of death did not last forever. Darby confesses that, "A few days before my unit left Abu Ghraib, all of a sudden people started worrying about mortar attacks for the first time. It was weird. They'd be huddling against the wall together. I found myself crouched in a corner, praying. The numbness was wearing off. That's one of the things you have to keep in mind when you look at the pictures. We all got numb in different ways." According to one high-ranking informant who worked there for several years, the prison remained a very dangerous place in which to work or be housed. In 2006, the military command finally decided to abandon it, but a bit too late to undo the damage caused by its earlier decision to resurrect it. Abu Ghraib prison was officially closed as of August 15, 2006, and all remaining prisoners shipped to Camp Cropper near the Baghdad airport. Compounding the woes of the soldiers, the war-torn Abu Ghraib prison had no sewage system, only holes in the ground and porta-potties. Even so, there were not enough outside porta-potties to accommodate all the prisoners and soldiers. Because they were not regularly emptied, they overflowed, and in the extreme summer temperatures, the stench was horrible for everyone all the time. There was also no adequate shower system. Water was rationed. There was no soap. Electricity went down regularly because there was no reliably operating generators. The prisoners stank, as did the whole facility that enclosed them. Under the heavy rains of summer, when temperatures soared well above 110 degrees Fahrenheit, 45 Celsius, the prison became a baking oven or sauna. During a windstorm, fine dust particles got into everyone's lungs, causing congestion and viral infections. After it was decided to demolish the tall tower in order to eliminate it as a siding target for insurgents, mortar attacks were on target less frequently, but that huge demolition added to the permanent debris in and degradation of the prison site. Nor did the quality of the food make up for the other deficiencies in the accommodations. Even though this large facility had recently been renovated by the U.S. Army, there were no mess halls. For more than 2 years after the occupation of Abu Ghraib, soldiers assigned to duty there were obliged to eat tea rations and MREs, meals ready to eat, out of containers. A mess hall was finally constructed in December 2003. In summary, I cannot express the scene better than did a warrant officer in charge of military investigations there, who told me just how terrible it was to work in such a place that, for a long time, resembled hell on earth. 80 acres of hell. American history buffs will remind us at this point that an even more hellish prison was created and maintained by the U.S. military during and after the Civil War. Camp Douglas was the prison a few miles outside of Chicago where thousands of captured Confederate prisoners were sent for safekeeping. It was poorly conceived on reclaimed swampland with inadequate resources, indecisive and lax leadership, no clear guidelines for dealing with POWs, and great hostility against these Confederate traitors on the part of local civilians and the small battalion of guards who supervised as many as 5,000 prisoners. Camp Douglas became known as 80 Acres of Hell because thousands of prisoners died there as slave laborers from starvation, brutal beatings, torture, willful mistreatment, and a host of contagious diseases and viral disorders. The equivalent Hell on Earth in the South for captured Union soldiers was the better-known Andersonville prison. The new commander arrives on sight, but sight unseen. In June 2003, a new officer was put in charge of the Iraqi prison disaster. Army Reserve Brigadier General Janis Karpinski was made commander of the 800th Military Police Brigade, which operated Abu Ghraib Prison and was in charge of all other military prisons in Iraq. The appointment was strange for two reasons. Karpinski was the only female commander in the war zone, and she had absolutely no experience in running any kind of prison system. Now she was supposed to command three large jails, 17 prisons throughout Iraq, 8 battalions of soldiers, hundreds of Iraqi guards, and 3,400 inexperienced army reservists, as well as the special interrogation center in Tier 1A. It was an overwhelming demand to be put on the shoulders of such an inexperienced army reserve officer. According to several sources, Karpinski soon abandoned her post at Abu Ghraib because of its dangers and awful living conditions, and retreated to the safety and security of Camp Victory near the Baghdad airport. Because Karpinski was off-site much of the time, traveling often to Kuwait, there was no top-down authoritative supervision of the facility on a day-to-day basis. Moreover, she claims that those higher up in the chain of command told her that Tier 1A was a special site and was not under her direct supervision, so she never visited it. Having a woman who was only nominally in charge also encouraged sexist attitudes among the soldiers that led to a breakdown in ordinary military discipline and order. General Karpinski's subordinates at Abu Ghraib at times disregarded her commands and didn't enforce codes on wearing uniforms and saluting superiors, which added to the lax standards that prevailed at the prison, said one member of the brigade. The soldier, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, also said that commanders in the field routinely ignored General Karpinski's orders, saying that they didn't have to listen to her because she was a woman. One task she did perform, after a fashion, consisted of weekly scrubs, where she made decisions about which prisoners should be released either because they were not dangerous or because they probably had no useful information and were neither insurgents nor criminals. However, I was told that Karpinski played it safe by releasing relatively few detainees, while many new prisoners were brought in daily. Therefore, the prison population continued to swell. To make matters worse, though few were leaving, there was a constant influx of new prisoners from other prisons, as, for example, when Camp Buka was overcrowded. As the prison population swelled to more than 10,000 during the first 6 months of Karpinski's tenure, there were, among those imprisoned, 30 juveniles, ages 10 to 17. For these children, not only were there no educational programs, but there were also no separate facilities. It was heartbreaking to see the conditions under which these young children were living for months on end, said one observer. In addition, nothing was done to provide separate arrangements for prisoners who were mentally ill or were suffering from a variety of contagious diseases, like TB. It is curious, then, that given the terrible conditions at Abu Ghraib, General Karpinski would give a thumbs-up report in an interview with the St. Petersburg Times in December 2003. She said that for many of the Iraqis imprisoned at Abu Ghraib, living conditions now are better in prison than living at home. However, at that very moment, as General Karpinski was giving such a cheery pre-Christmas interview, Major General Antonio Taguba was conducting an investigation of reports of numerous incidents of sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses perpetrated by her Army Reserve soldiers in the 372nd Military Police Company from the night shift on Tier 1A. General Karpinski was later admonished, suspended from duty, officially reprimanded, and removed from this command. She was also demoted to the rank of colonel and retired from the service. She was the first officer to be found blameworthy in the investigation of prisoner abuses for her sins of omission and ignorance, not for anything she did, but for what she did not do. In her autobiography, One Woman's Army, Karpinski tells her side of the story. She recounts the visit of an army team from Guantanamo, headed by Major General Jeffrey Miller, who told her, "We're going to change the nature of the interrogation at Abu Ghraib." That meant taking off the kid gloves to stop being so soft on these suspected insurgents and to start using tactics that would get actionable intelligence needed in the war against terrorists and insurgents. Miller also insisted that the official name of the prison cease to be the Baghdad Central Confinement Facility, BCCF, and return to its original designation, which was still feared among the Iraqi population, Abu Ghraib Prison. She also notes that Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, repeated the theme that General Miller had laid down about prisoners and detainees being nothing more than like dogs, and the need to get tougher in dealing with them. In Karpinski's view, her superior officers, Generals Miller and Sanchez, set a new agenda for dehumanization and torture at Abu Ghraib. The person. I'd like to introduce Chip Frederick. I first met Chip Frederick on September 30th, 2004, when his legal counsel, Gary Myers, arranged for me to spend a day with him and his wife, Martha, in San Francisco. While we engaged in an in-depth four-hour interview, Martha did a bit of sightseeing, after which we had lunch at my home in Russian Hill. Since that time, I've had an active correspondence with Chip Frederick, and I have been in phone and email contact with Martha and with Chip's older sister, Mimi Frederick.